So, Dr. Shea, another chapter, you know, another in your book that I really liked was the issue of interviewing paranoid patients. Because people who have persecutory ideation, they are particularly challenging both to engage and to deal with their reactions towards you, and for them to, you know, open up to you. It's really a very difficult skill. What would be some tips for interviewing patients who are paranoid?
Yeah, you know, that's something that I actually address that in the very first chapter of the book. And one of the things that I try to do is the first, you know, part one of the book is about core interviewing techniques. I try to present the basics in a very understandable way, but in a sophisticated way. And I think it needs to be tied in with what you're going to do in a clinic or on an inpatient unit. So you don't just teach empathy in the first chapter. You also teach it in such a way that they understand that it's a pretty complex thing. It's not just being empathic with people. So I'll give you a good example of that. I had as a resident a fair amount of problems in my beginning work with paranoid patients. They might get angry with me, or you know, start to you know, pull me into the delusion or whatever. And eventually we figured out what is going on. And what is going on with that is that empathy is a very effective use of empathy, which means intentional use of empathy. You know, we do it habitually in a good sense, which is good. But sometimes the habit can be a problem, because just like there are different people that we are uncovering suicidal ideation, you know, a 20-80er versus a 95-5er, and they handle the questions differently.
Right.
When you use empathy, people handle empathy differently. And a large number of people really like it, obviously. But there is a chunk of people that do not want us to be empathic. And a perfect example of that is a paranoid patient, because the last thing they want is somebody inside their head. In fact, the paranoid defenses are built there to give some distance.
Yeah.
And we realized that when you look at empathic statements, we realized that they have a different power to either effectively engage, and with paranoid patients, to effectively disengage. So the empathic questions that are very powerful with most people are also the ones that are most likely to backfire with paranoid patients.
Right.
So you can see where I could get into a problem, because if you tend to be a very empathic interviewer and you just habitually share your empathy, if you do that with a paranoid patient, it might not go so well. So let me give you an example. We actually call this the valence of the empathic statement. The valence meaning the degree with which it will either pull the things together or pull them apart. There's two continuums of valence when you use an empathic statement. The first one, Raj, is I can state to you, I will meta-communicate to you with my empathic statement how certain I am that I'm right.
Okay.
Okay. So there's the axis of the valence of certitude or certainty.
Okay.
So I can turn to you and I can say, it sounds like that's a really difficult situation. That doesn't imply a lot of certainty, okay, because I said it sounds like. Instead, I could say, that's a very difficult situation. That's indicating to them, I think it's a difficult situation. So you can see the difference.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, actively paranoid patients, and there are always going to be exceptions, and I'm not going to stereotype paranoid, but generally speaking, an actively paranoid patient does not like certitude in empathic statements.
Okay.
And what they will often do is they'll disavow it, and they'll say that's not exactly true or whatever. And the second axis or valence is even more striking with paranoia. And that's the degree with which you and I, as interviewers, especially experienced interviewers, really have a knack to intuit what's going on with somebody. In fact, some of our most powerful empathic statements of a talented interviewer is that we really hook people early in an interview because we show an almost uncanny knack to understand their pain.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example of that. A person is telling you they're really having a hard time at work. Their boss is outrageous. Their colleagues are not helping them to stand up to what the boss is making them do. You think there's some unethical stuff going on in the office. And you want to communicate, you know, empathy to the person. And there's a couple of different things you could do. And the patient says to you, it's just so difficult for me. I could literally with a very low valence. In other words, this is not going to really hook someone dramatically, but it's also not going to distance a paranoid patient as bad. I could use a very simple reflection of that. This sounds like a difficult situation at work. I'm almost reflecting back. The vast majority of people will be comfortable with that. I got to tell you, even a paranoid patient might not even like that. But watch what happens if we use a really good empathic statement, a high valence of intuition. So I'm sitting there with this patient and I go, "It sounds like a really lonely place to be, Jim." Now, he didn't mention anything about loneliness.
Yeah.
But I'm looking at what's going on at this job, and it sounds like a lonely, isolated place to be. With the vast majority of the patients who come to see, that is a hugely powerful empathic statement. And they go, "You're exactly right. I'm all alone in this office." And you know, that's a patient who's going to come back.
Yeah.
Okay. And so we use that in our private practices, etc. But I got to imagine if you use that with an actively paranoid patient.
Right.
That's a lonely place to be. They'll say something like, "I didn't say it was a lonely place to be. I said it was a tough place to be."
Yeah.
And you'll see them disavow the thing. Now, one of the things that we saw, and so here's the bottom line. Generally, paranoid patients do not like empathic statements, and I don't use a lot of with them. And if I'm going to use one, I'm going to use a very low valence one. I typically will say "it sounds like," and I usually reflect back exactly what they just said. But generally speaking, with paranoid patients, I avoid empathic statements and only low valence. If the low valence one backfires, and they're no very quickly, they will literally disavow it, attack it, etc., then I just stop using empathic statements.
Okay.
On the other hand, with the vast majority of people, I'm going to start with usually low valence empathic statements of both certitude, it sounds like, and then also intuition. But then as I move into this interview, if I got a good feeling that I know what's going on, I'm going to use a high valence empathic statement, especially on intuition, because they really hook people.
Yes.
Now, with paranoid patients, you know, as a resident, where was I running into problems? Well, first of all, you can just watch me. I'm fairly animated, okay?
Yes.
So I talk fairly fast. I gesture a lot. I don't know if you can see that on anything. I have very good eye contact, you know, with patients. And I tended, just by habit, to use a lot of empathic statements, and a lot of them were fairly intuitive. And that's why I tended to really do well with patients.
Right.
But when I started working in an ED or on a unit where there was actively paranoid patients, I was surprised I was having troubles engaging with them. And in watching people as I became the medical director and was studying interviewing in the emergency room, we figured out what was going on. And what was going on with this process is a interaction we call the paranoid spiral, that you take a good interviewer who is naturally empathic and tends to use empathy very quickly and uses a lot of intuition. They're in the room with an actively paranoid patient, and the patient disavows it, says, "I didn't say I was lonely. I said it was difficult."
Yeah.
What happens in the interviewer, and you may find it yourself, I certainly did, is because it didn't work, my tendency is, "Oh, this isn't, I'm not making a good engagement, so I'm more empathic."
Yeah.
I use another empathic statement.
So that's the spiral. That's the spiral.
Later I say another, the patient says, "That's not how I'm seeing it. That might be how you're seeing it." And then I internally feel, "Oh, this is not." So what do I do? What's worked with 98% of all my patients in my life? I use another empathic statement.
Yeah.
And I've actually seen in an interview in an ED, this thing, the thing just spiral down. The patient getting more and more pissed off. The interviewer trying harder and harder to engage them. We call that the paranoid spiral. And I've been able, with residents and the other trainees we use, social workers, clinical psychologists — by the way, the book is great for all those disciplines — but I've been able now, once we teach them about the valence of empathy, we literally, they understand it, they get it, and they can prevent these paranoid spirals. Anyway, that's, I think, a sophisticated understanding of empathy. By the way, I'll take you one step further. A really experienced clinician like ourselves, who now understands this valence and how it can backfire with paranoid patients, there's another sort of uber sophisticated aspect of it. And that is, you're working in an ED, you're working on an inpatient unit or a community mental health center, you've had someone referred by an outpatient psychotherapist, and you know nothing about this patient. Okay. So what we said is, generally speaking, sometime early in the interview, you're going to use a few low valence empathic statements, okay? Just by nature, you're intentionally use them, and they usually are very effective. If in that early part of that interview, we call the early 7 minutes or 8 minutes the scouting phase of the interview, if you use a typically engaging empathic statement and the patient disavows it, says, that's not how I see it, or that's not, I didn't say that. That may be, to an experienced clinician, the first hint, whoa, this guy might be paranoid.
Right.
Because you know that is not how 98% of people respond to that thing. So now you got a thing where the experienced clinician, because they understand the valence of empathic statements and the paranoid response to it, it actually can help them to figure out early in an interview,
right,
this guy might be actively paranoid. Two things happen. One, you are going to try later in the interview to see if I can pull forth the delusional material. And the second thing is, I know that from that point forwards, I'm not going to use much empathy at all,
right,
because it's probably going to disengage this guy.
Dr. Shah, these are both wonderful, sophisticated points. I must say that, you know, I had many years of experience and I didn't know these points until I read them in your book, both these,
thanks,
these issues. So that was very helpful. Thank you for that.